Okay. But a critic has this quotation that I thought was really fun. "Most of us carelessly define spirit and supernature as entities or functions that are not physical, intellectual, or emotional, and either reject them out of hand as fantasies or treat them with an inexcusable sentimentality or lack of intelligence." But William's characters operate from the closely reasoned conviction that the powers of the universe are one and in exchange and become incarnate in many ways. To them, it is no more surprising that the communion elements can be disintegrated by willing their annihilation than that the intention of a husband or wife to separate should dissolve a marriage or an acid neutralizes a base. Forces that are authentically supernatural play upon natural events. And the life of the spirit is conceived of as being real, as potent, and fundamentally as natural as the ordinary material and mental functions of our ordinary existence. It is not a matter of spiritualism. Williams believes that all of his creatures are moving toward order or chaos, coherence or incoherence, and whichever way we take, we have access to the supernatural, and it has access to us. William's concern is that we see and live in the coherence of all things, personal and spiritual, as well as intellectual and historical, as well as philosophical and scientific. None of this abstracted rational knowledge or intelligence. And then there's just a one-liner that's really lovely. The logic of an intellectual heart. You know, combining all of those thoughts, mind and spirit, you know, right together. Okay. The personal, the spiritual, the intellectual, the historical, the philosophical, the scientific. All exchanged, culminating in oneness, like the high priest prayer last night, which defines a manner of living in which even space and time become subordinate to loving and being loved, knowing and being known. In this movement, then, between the natural and the supernature. And I'd like to restate this choice that he offers us again in using the critic, Schindler. I think it's kind of Scottish, and I'm not quite certain if I'm pronouncing it right. Okay, it's on page 43. Oh, this has the best quote in it, too. It's really good. "Most of us have been taught that our intellects and emotions are fundamentally incompatible. So we let them go their separate ways and endure the consequences of disintegrity, believing that they are inherent in the nature of man. In fear or false humility, our little minds were never meant, or ordinary laziness, we do not ask the penetrating question that would lead to integrity." Reminds me of Prufrock right there. The penetrating questions that would lead to integrity. "Or we accept the shallow answers that give immediate consolation. Because responsibility implies judgment, we take refuge in the belief that we are not ultimately accountable for our lives, or if we are, that God will let us off with a reprimand, and we succumb to well-meant entreaties that we view the Christian life as that dreadful thing which you can sometimes smell, the hearty adventure of religion." Oh, that is just so good right there. I guess because I've just eaten that kind of thought, you know, it's so, ugh. "Clear your mind of cant," Williams wrote in a review that took the form of a letter to a young friend. "Be skeptical of what you have been taught. Be equally suspicious of the demand for immediate relevance and the plea to remain above the battle, of the insistence that the faith can be rationally justified in the assertion that it exhibits mysteries. Above all, doubt your cherished convictions, and doubt bravely and unceasingly the validity of those misgivings that are the protection and prison of the cowardly in spirit. Our intellects as well as our bodies, and probably more than our bodies, are infested with sin and permeated with grace. The subtler, more complex structure is open to more influences and capable of greater variations, so that the cold sins of the mind are more abominable than those of the tempestuous and unruly flesh. And not to ask the great questions of life and death, or to ask them only as theoretical puzzles, is to enter upon the way of damnation. Williams believed that we are free to accept or to reject the Christian worldview, but not to evade the choice, because evasion is equivalent to rejection. Therefore, the effect of his writings is to compel a clear-cut decision, even from those who desire above all else not to decide unequivocally, or not to confess to themselves what decision they have tacitly made. So in that decision, is it going to be coherence or incoherence? And Descent into Hell deals with the two choices. Let me talk about the incoherent first, as I go into the book now. The symbol of incoherence and descent into hell is Lawrence Wentworth, who's an historian. And his statement of his incoherence is this: he died to things other than himself. He died to things other than himself. There was a time in his life, around 50 he was, and the question of death came up. The question of his profession came up, in that his chief rival received a knighthood. He had fallen in love for the first time, and the girl jilted him. And all of these were tempting him then to self-indulgence. And that's exactly what he succumbed to. He became self-indulgence. And there's a hymn line that says, "We love our sin," and Wentworth desired hell. And in the Descent into Hell, it portrays how he slowly, and the images of a rope, went down the rope to his way beyond Gomorrah to hell. And there are a couple of lines that I would like to share with you about this. With Wentworth, he did precisely what Nancy talked about on Sunday. He didn't want to be called by his name. He didn't want anything to change his life. He didn't want any relationships. The whole way of exchange was denied. And in turning in upon himself then, he even went so far as to fabricate a lover. And she was identical to Adela, the girl that jilted him, except that she responded to everything that he wanted. And let's see if I have this line. He refers to her in this way. He wanted to have his own way under the pretext of giving her hers. And that's what this dummy was. He was really getting his own way through the dummy on the pretext of giving her hers. The ironic thing is that Adela comes to him at the end and wants him to help her. And by that time, he is so introverted that he just pushes her away with, "I don't know you, I don't want to know you." And then she falls in a faint, and the only thing that he can think about as he drags her down to the road is, "What if she wakes up while I'm dragging her, and then I'll have to deal with her again?" And there's another little teeny line in here that I think is really good. It's, "Malice is much cozier than love." And then I'll read to you again what Elise read tonight, because that whole image of Gomorrah, which is what Wentworth, you know, was traveling through, is an image of no sound, of silent streets, because you look at yourself. The lover is the beloved. And that's here. I'll start up a little bit. Pauline is talking to Stanhope. Pauline is the girl that Stanhope carried the burden for. And she says to him that he's got a head start just because he's carried the burden for her. He shook his head. "No," he said, "our handicaps are all different and the race is equal. The Pharisees can even catch up with the woman with the mites. Those who do not insist on Gomorrah, she said Gomorrah, and the chill of the word struck even through her contemplation. She remembered the unanswered question of her vision, what of them that have not? As if the answer had been reserved for those lower circles, he gave it. He said, the Lord's glory fell on the cities of the plain of Sodom and another. We know all about Sodom nowadays, but perhaps we know the other even better. Men can be in love with men and women with women and still be in love and make sounds and speeches, but don't you know how quiet the streets of Gomorrah are? Haven't you seen the pools that everlastingly reflect the faces of those who walk with their own phantasms? But the phantasms aren't reflected and can't be. The lovers of Gomorrah are quite contented, Periel. They don't have to put up with our difficulties. They aren't bothered by alteration, at least till the reign of the fire of the glory at the end. For they lose the capacity for change, except for the fear of hell. They're monogamous enough, and they've no children, no cherubim breaking into being, or babies as tiresome as ours. There's no birth there, and only the second death. There's no distinction between lover and beloved. They beget themselves on their adoration of themselves, and they live and feed and starve on themselves. And by themselves, too, for creation, as my predecessor said, is the mercy of God, and they won't have the facts of creation. No, we don't talk much of Gomorrah, and perhaps it's as well, and perhaps not. And that really is the best statement for incoherence, for denying the way of exchange. And I'll read to you then a couple pages on coherence. We talked more fully about that, and I wanted to read this to you last night, but there wasn't time, so I'll do so now. This is a little bit longer, so you can sit back and kind of listen.
Where are you?
I'm talking about, on page 96, John. Okay. Three paragraphs from the bottom. But, he said, that I don't quite understand. You have friends. Haven't you asked one of them to carry your fear? Carry my fear, she said, sitting rigid in her chair so that her arms, which had lain so lightly, pressed now into the basket work, and her long, firm fingers gripped it as if they strangled her own heart. How can anyone else carry my fear? Can anyone else see it and have to meet it? Still, in that public place, leaning back easily, as if they talked of casual things, he said, you're mixing up two things. Think a moment, and you'll see. The meeting it, that's one thing, and we can leave it till you're rid of the other. It's the fear we're talking about. Has no one ever relieved you of that? Haven't you ever asked them to? She said, you haven't understood, of course. I was a fool. Let's forget it. Isn't Mrs. Perry efficient? Extremely, he answered. And God redeem her, but nicely. Will you tell me whether you've any notion of what I'm talking about? And if not, will you let me do it for you? She attended reluctantly, as if to attend were an unhappy duty she owed him, as she had owed others to others, and tried to fulfill them. She said politely, do it for me? It can be done, you know, he went on. It's surprisingly simple, and if there's no one else you care to ask, why not use me? I'm here at your disposal, and we could so easily settle it that way. Then you needn't fear it, at least, and then again for the meeting. That might be a very different business if you weren't distressed. But how can I not be afraid? She asked. It's hellish nonsense to talk like that. I suppose that's rude, but it's no more nonsense than your own story, he said. That isn't very well. This isn't. We all know what fear and trouble are very well. When you leave here, you'll think of yourself that I've taken this particular trouble over instead of you. You'd do as much for me if I needed it, or for anyone, and I will give myself to it. I'll think of what comes to you and imagine it and know it and be afraid of it, and then, you see, you won't. She looked at him as if she were beginning to understand that, at any rate, he thought he was talking about a reality. And as she did so, something of her feeling for him returned. It was, after all, Peter Stanhope who was talking to her like this. Peter Stanhope was a great poet. Were great poets liars? No, but they might be mistaken. Yes, so might she. She said very doubtfully, but I don't understand. It isn't your... You haven't seen it. How can you? He indicated the rehearsal before them. Come, he said. If you like that, will you tell me... if you like that, will you tell me that I must see in order to know? That's not pride. And if it were, it wouldn't matter. Listen, when you go from here, when you're alone, when you think you'll be afraid, let me put myself in your place and be afraid instead of you. He sat up and leaned towards her. It's so easy, he went on, easy for both of us. It needs only the act. For what can be, and I just have to stop there. I never heard this definition of act before, but it's simply the beginning and closing of things. And I thought, how astounding that things can begin and close. I don't think we do that very often. I just think we let them drift. And I don't think we come to a closing like that. Well, for what can be simpler than for you to think to yourself that since I'm here to be troubled instead of you, therefore you needn't be troubled? And what can be easier than for me to carry a little while a burden that isn't mine? She said, still perplexed at a strange language, but how can I cease to be troubled? Will it leave off coming because I pretend it wants you? Is it your resemblance that hurries up the street? It is not, he said, and you shall not pretend at all. The thing itself you may one day meet. Never mind that now. But you'll be free from all the distress because that you can pass on to me. Haven't you heard it said that we ought to bear one another's burdens? But that means, she began and stopped. I know, Stanhope says. It means listening sympathetically and thinking unselfishly and being anxious about and so on. Well, I don't say a word against all that. No doubt it helps. But I think when Christ or St. Paul or whoever said what, or whatever the Aramaically, or whatever he Aramaically said instead of bear, he meant, no, oh, excuse me, right, instead of bear, he meant something much more like carrying a parcel instead of someone else. To bear a burden is precisely to carry it instead of. If you're still carrying yours, I'm not carrying it for you, however sympathetic I may be. And anyhow, there's no need to introduce Christ unless you wish. It's a fact of experience. If you give a weight to me, you can't be carrying it yourself. All I'm asking you to do is to notice that blazing truth. It doesn't sound very difficult. And if I could, she said, if I could do it, whatever it is you mean, would I? Would I push my burden onto anybody else? Not if you insist on making a universe for yourself, he answered. If you want to disobey and refuse the laws that are common to us all, if you want to live in pride and division and anger, you can. But if you will be part of the best of us and live and laugh and be ashamed with us, then you must be content to be helped. You must give your burden up to someone else, and you must carry someone else's burden. I haven't made the universe, and it isn't my fault, but I'm sure that this is a law of the universe, and not to give up your parcel is as much to rebel as not to carry another's. You'll find it quite easy if you let yourself do it. And what of my self-respect, she said. He laughed at her with a tender mockery. Oh, if we are of that kind, he exclaimed. If you want to respect yourself, if to respect yourself you must go clean against the nature of things, if you must refuse the omnipotence in order to respect yourself, though why you should want to so extremely to respect yourself is more than I can guess, why go on and respect. Must I apologize for suggesting anything else? And that's the initial contact for the way of exchange. And as I was thinking of Sonia and my compact, one of the things that I was really questioning when we first agreed to do this was, what do I have to do, you know? If I make a compact and we're called to do that, you know, do I have to sit up all night and meditate on Sonia, you know, or whatever the thing is, you know? And it really kind of, I mean, it's such a common sense thing, and I hadn't been introduced to it before, and I really didn't have a lot of common sense. You know, I had these big dramatic martyr things running through my head like sugar plums, ha. Huh? No. But I'll read to you what Stanhope did, a short section of how Williams describes what the actual experience was. And now, I don't, when I read this to you, and if you decide to do a compact with someone, you know, as if you feel that that's a direction you should go, you know, this isn't the prescription for how you should act or what you should decide to do. But it's just an illumination that might give you a context from which to stand on. And then I'm sure through prayer that, you know, the other answers for that will come as to your relationship. When she does exchange it with him, it's not that, you know, she never doubts him after that. There's one time when her grandmother is dying, and it's at 1 o'clock in the morning, and she calls for Pauline, and she tells Pauline to go out into the street at that time in the morning and meet a man and to tell him to go back to the other world. Well, they thought this was the deliriums of death and, you know, all those rational reasons you can give for someone sending you on a really absurd trip like that. She didn't want to go, and I wouldn't want to go at that hour of the night anyway because I'm afraid of the dark. No. But she does go, and right before she goes, she calls Stanhope, you know, because she just thinks, I just have to have this reaffirmed. And he answers the telephone, and she said, you know, I wanted to call you, but when I called you, I didn't want to call you. And it was just kind of in the same moment, you know. It's like that two-statement theology. You say this, and you almost need another mouth to say the same thing. You know, she had the anxiety, and yet at the same time, it was brought together. And that was really refreshing. Okay, this is what he does. Stanhope, turning his eyes from her parting figure, looked at the rehearsal, and then, this is the rehearsal of the play. He's written a play, and they're performing it. That's really the basic plot of the whole book. There's not a lot of action besides the ideas running around, which are enough. Stanhope, turning his eyes from her parting figure, looked at the rehearsal and then settled himself more comfortably into his chair. A certain superficial attention, alert and effective in its degree, lay at the disposal of anyone who might need it, exactly as his body was prepared to draw in its long, outstretched legs if anyone wanted to pass. Oh, John, I'm on page 100, in case you want to follow along. Meanwhile, he disposed the rest of his attention according to his promise. He recollected Pauline. He visualized her going along a road, any road. He visualized another Pauline coming to meet her. And as he did so, his mind contemplated not the first, but the second Pauline. He took trouble to apprehend the vision. He summoned through all his sensations an approaching fear. Deliberately, he opened himself to that fear, laying aside for a while every thought of why he was doing it, forgetting every principle and law, absorbing only the strangeness and the terror of that separate spiritual identity. His more active mind reflected it in an imagination of himself going into his house and seeing himself. But he dismissed that, for he desired to subdue himself, not to have his own natural sensations, but to hers first, and then to let hers, if so it should happen, be drawn back into his own. But it was necessary first intensely to receive all her spirit's conflict. He sat on, imagining to himself the long walk with its sinister possibility, the ogreish world lying around, the air with its treachery to all sane appearance. His own eyes began to sink and strain and shrink. His own feet, quiet though actually they were, began to weaken with the necessity of advance upon the road down which the girl was passing. The body of his flesh received her alien terror. His mind carried the burden of her world. The burden was inevitably lighter for him than for her, for the rage of a personal resentment was lacking. That's important. For the rage of a personal resentment was lacking. He endured her sensitiveness, but not her sin. The substitution there, if indeed there is a substitution, is hidden in a central mystery of Christendom, which Christendom itself has never understood, nor can. Since he could not take, nor would have admitted, her hate and rejection, her passion was received into the lucidity of his own spirit. The experience itself, sharply as his body took it, was less sharp for him, not that he willed it so, but because his senses received their communication from within, not from without. And there is in all holy imagination from goodwill a quality of greatness which purifies and stabilizes experience. His goodwill went to the utmost, and utmost goodwill can go very far. It went to all but actual vision, and it excluded his intellectual judgment of that vision. Had he not been asked at that moment for his judgment, he would have answered that he believed sincerely that Pauline believed sincerely that she saw. But whether the sight was actual or not, he could not tell. He would have admitted that it might be but a fantastic obsession of her brain. That made no difference to his action. If a man seems to himself to endure the horrors of shipwreck, though he walks on dry land and breathes clear air, the business of his friend is more likely to be to accept those horrors as he feels them, carrying the burden, than to explain that the burden cannot, as a matter of fact, exist. And another observation about Stanhope from the book is that he is very practiced in this kind of experience, and I think that has a sense of it. I think you really grow in prayer as you pray. And Stanhope is, I mean, I think that's a very vivid image of someone taking over someone else's fear. And I, as William said yesterday in his essay, you know, start where it's easy. You know, don't think you have to go out and conquer the world for that. Well, are there any questions about that? That was very briefly Descent into Hell. And then Sonia's going to talk a little bit about All Hallows Eve now. Then maybe after Sonia, then we'll ask some questions, unless there's something pressing on someone that I wasn't clear with. Okay.
All Hallows Eve like in all the novels, it's like the good and the evil, and you choose along the way, and it's about two girls, and they were killed in a plane crash, and how one of them chooses along the way, and then the other one chooses along the way. The main character is Lester, and I'd like to talk about her and another girl who is alive. However, and her name is Patty, and Patty's father is demonic. He's a magician, and he is preparing her to help him to carry on his work. And it's how Lester and Patty co-inhere, and they substitute. And in this, he really has a pronounced interaction between the natural and the supernatural. He has a lot of themes running through here of the coherence of the redeemed city, of water in baptism, the baptism in the water one is really fascinating, and I was reading in his essay of the redeemed city, which has an excellent section in there in baptism that I will read. Patty is protected by her mother, and Betty does not know the magician is her father, and she thinks that she is adopted by her mother and this other man. But as a little child, her nurse took her and she baptized her, unbeknown to the mother and the father. And it's the water. She has dreams of the water, and the water in the book is very significant, and in the end is also the salvation of them. Let me read what he has in his essay to say about baptism, because it really ties in with the co-inherence and the inhering, as it is in the baptism, as it is in a compact, as it is in resurrection, and as it began as the fetus is in the womb, in the very natural, in the physical state. The newborn child emerges from its natural co-inherence in its mother into a supernatural co-inherence with the saints. It has received the communication of the evil of a fallen world. Its blood is tainted from its soul, or from a world of souls, with the infamy, and it will soon begin disastrously to pay back what it has disastrously received in the exchanges, unless redeemed, of internal conflict. At that moment, this is the baptism. It is caught by others and lifted into an exchange of grace, into others, by others, into another with a capital A, by another. As the practice of infant baptism became general in the church, this co-inherence was the more accentuated. The adult might speak for himself. The infant could speak only by others. Repentance and faith, the two first held and first pledged qualities of the new life, had to be on its behalf held and pledged by others. The inarticulate young creature, as it were, repented before he could sin and believed before he could think. Mystically vicarious, the sponsors were pledged, and their pledge was not released until duly instructed in the vicarious life of the city. The subject of those pledges himself affirmed his own part in that life and was permitted himself to approach the vicarious sacrifice and to feed on the vicarious nourishment. The operation of the Spirit, who is the life of the human image toward its divine original and had been so invoked in the baptism, claimed its votary in the confirmation. That life stretched before him no more its own than it had been before, but now consciously known not to be its own. And this city, which is the co-inherence of the saints and believers, is what upholds. It was like a double co-inherence. When Simon the clerk or the magician is about ready to perform his final operation or act on Betty, Lester is in the room, and because Lester isn't living, the magician, he doesn't know she's in the room. However, Patty, because of the co-inherence, knows that she is there and she can see her. And
just one reason why he doesn't know that she's in the room is that he and Lady Wallingford have closed off their daughter from any contact, just personal contact. So he's not suspicious that a creature from the other world, he can see creatures from the other world, but he just doesn't have any, you know, suspicion that anyone could come because they've so totally isolated the daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And it, just those small concrete acts, it just comes over and over again, you know, how important they are. You know, they really are the foundations.
And as it also, he said, he knew of, this is the clerk was Simon, he knew, of course, nothing of the exchange of the redeeming love that had taken place between these two, no more than of the gal Betty who had arisen one from the lake of wise water, of the baptism. And if he had known anything of what a conceivable importance could the memories of the two schoolgirls be to him, even though the memories of those girls should be the acts of souls. It was out of his world, this redeeming in the coherence. And Patty is weakening, and Lester, she holds her hand, and she keeps on calling to Betty, "I am here, I am here. Remain with me here." And as this is happening, Lester felt the strange intoning call of this magician, call not to Betty but to her, and this is when she is beginning to take on Betty's struggle against the magician. And as this is happening, this is what happens to Lester. Of one other thing she was conscious, she had been standing and now she was no longer standing. She was leaning back on something, some frame which from her buttocks to her head supported her. Indeed, she could have believed, but she was not sure that her arms flung out on each side held on to a part of the frame as along a beam of wood. And then as she pressed against this frame, she pressed herself against that sole support. So those greater than she had come, the saints, and the martyrs, and the confessors, but they joyously, knowing that this was the first movement of their re-edification in the city, and that thus in that earliest world, fashioned of their earthly fantasies, began the raising of the true houses and streets. Neither her mind nor her morals had prepared her for this discovery, nor did she in the least guess what was happening. But what of integrity she possessed clung to that other integrity. Her back pressed to it. It sustained her. And as Lester was cohering for Patty, the church or the city, as it's called, or the saints of living and the dead, were upholding her.
Sometimes called the communion of saints.
Yeah, the communion of saints. This is also in this city of he takes the last paragraph of the Apostles' Creed, and he in this is the city, yeah. And in this whole theme of the communion of saints, it was really honed in the book. And when I had read it, I hadn't read The Redeemed City, his essay, which I think reading the novel makes you want to read his essays, and reading his essays makes you want to read the novel. right. I wasn't going to get it into that, but this is excellent. Would you read this paragraph here
This is from the essay of the city. In the last paragraph of the Apostles' Creed, the city is defined. I believe in the Holy Ghost is its first clause and primal condition. If it is living, it lives so and only so towards Christ, in whom it already lives complete. Having, by virtue of his substitution, the perfect and simultaneous possession of everlasting life, simultaneously all its citizens derive from all. The Holy Catholic Church is its name here, allowing for all the proper implications of whatever kind, visible, invisible, invincible ignorance, and so on. But the other four clauses are, as it were, the four walls of the description of the apocalypse, or if the metaphor divides them too much, say they are the four qualities of that life: the communion of saints, the forgiveness of sins, the resurrection of the body, and the life everlasting. They are the qualities of the renewed perfection of union, interchange redeeming even the denial of itself, the glory of the holy flesh by which so much was known, the infinite power in all the glory. The glory is the thing happening. It is not, though in our talk we seem to make it so and can only believe it is so, an accident of the thing happening. The glory of God is in facts. The almost incredible nature of things is that there is no fact which is not in his glory. This is the great inclusion which makes the city. If to use terms of space we ascend towards it, it is still that which descends out of space, and it is the cause and course of our ascent. The language of it is in the great interchange of fiery tongues by which the Spirit manifested at the beginning.
I love that. It's easy to get into the images, and when you read them, it's like looking into another world through his eyes, and he has a capacity of imagery which is it expands your world, because we can look into his world in his writings, which is neat. And I think also as we talk about the essays in relation with the novels and the neat images and the neat ideas of what is rolling in his mind. He also, Lewis, he wrote the introduction in All Hallows Eve. He also mentions that you could pick up a novel of his and read it as you would book you picked up in an airport bookstore, and because they are also delightful, he's imaginative, and they are enjoyable, even if you do not go into all the images. And he gives you a taste of his wide imagination. I don't look at them as I'm afraid. This one at the beginning, I thought this is kind of spooky, you know, because you are reading about two people who are walking around, and it's in the twilight most of the time, and they are interacting, and
they're dead.
Yeah, they're not living, and as you read on, it becomes intriguing, and it isn't spooky anymore. It's widening out your a little peek into maybe the unknown of our living and of our times. It's expanding. I would rather not talk more on All Hallows Eve. It comes out as a coherence ought to, as they lift each other up, and that is a kind of an extension onto the continuing acts of the salvations in our lives. Have you got any added informations or questions or any comments or how about you, Karen?
I was just thinking when we were talking with Elise that really All Hallows Eve is sort of a love story too. It's really tremendous to see how the husband and wife grow to know each other after she's dead, you know, in the sense that the supernatural comes back or is with the natural. Just has some, like, we have about 10 minutes. I mean, legally we have 10 minutes. Just a couple of quotes. All right, this one quote that's my particular favorite. I should use my book because it's marked, yeah. Or I know where it's at. It's about saying goodbye. If you ever have a lover say goodbye to you again, you'll have to think about this line.
Oh.
Here it is. I have to apologize to Liz because every time I got excited about this, I'd run over to her and say, listen to this, listen to this. his wife as the plane hits him on the bridge. These two ladies standing on the bridge. She was waiting for him, and he's walking down the street, and he sees her across the intersection, his dead wife. And she looks at him, and then she turns away. And at that moment, he has this new observation about her. And this is a lovely line. The recognition was in her stillness. This was their thousandth meeting, but yet more than their first, a new first, and yet the only first. More stable than rock, more transient in herself than rivers, more distant bright than stars, more comfortable than happy sleep. More pleasant than wind, more dangerous than fire, all known things similes of her, and beyond all known things the unknown power of her. He could perhaps in a little have spoken, but before he could she had passed. She left him precisely the sensation of seeing her go on. Past him? No. Up the byway? No. But it was not disappearance or vanishing, for she had gone, as 100 times she had on her proper occasions gone, kissing, laughing, waving. Now she neither kissed nor laughed nor waved, but that which was in all three lingered with him as he saw she was no longer there. Lights were coming out in the houses. The confused sound of the city was in his ears. He was giddy with too much apprehension. He waited to recover. Then he crossed the byway, and he too went on. Isn't that just exquisite? Mm-hmm. It's just ofte. And that's his whole, the whole book. And he's fun. I mean, he's just, you have such a good laughter with him, too. Sometimes, it took me a long time to read these books because of his style, I think. He moves, and the whole plot goes on, and then all of a sudden, all he's talking about are two adjectives, and he has two pages on that, and it just, all these thoughts and images come out with that. But like Sonia said, I think it was Eliot that did the introduction, T.S. Eliot did the introduction for Williams. You could read him in an airport, but there's so much more than that. I mean, you have so much of a head start on him now, just being here and everything. It really is. Fun. Are there any questions on coherence? Because that's what we really wanted to present to the village, that whole kind of thought and that.
Something that maybe is too obvious, but when I was reading the Hell's Eve one, and it was really exciting, the part you read when she was leaning back on that thing. Mm-hmm. This is what I'm afraid to say because maybe it's too obvious, but it was a cross.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's one of the high points of the whole book. I think it's the most exciting part of the book is that when it suddenly hits you, my gosh, it's the cross. That's what, it's just it's just tremendous.
And what is scary at the same time at something like that, and yet so totally like a warm breath of spring, is that too is in our days. Particularly, the cross experience didn't particularly strike me, but Wentworth, ay, 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 when he would go on about his sin and his drawing into himself, and all the intrusions I just hate to have, and all the lack of change I want to claim to, all the things I don't want to move, that's a kind of hell that we're in. And something else that I always say is that we're not punished by our sins, but for our sins. That pride has, we're not punished for, but by, But there's another line in here. I always say this so I get it wrong. And this is the same extension about Wentworth's acts. His own acts judged him. His thoughts and words and behavior had consequences that redounded upon him according to their nature. That's like spitting in the wind, having to go all around the world and come back and hit you in the face. Jealousy smacks back of jealousy. You are the victim of jealousy and all of those things, and it's just, boy, you start seeing a clear picture of that and you really get down on your knees quick. And you do that often. I mean, it really forces you into conversation with the Lord.
Which is another way of saying conversation with reality.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. And we didn't talk about the nowness of things, but remember this line, the holy carelessness of the eternal now. And it's not that you diagram your moments. You wish you were someplace else, or what am I going to do, you know? I mean, you think about those. Like Lewis says, you know, you live each day and plan for the next 100. But there's a real sense of being called to the immediate present, you know, and enjoying it. Whether you're mad or angry or whatever. I really got angry today. And I came up to Sonia and I was really laughing afterwards. I read about this laughter thing too, but I thought, well, even in anger, I can just be called to anger for the moment. And then that washes away too, you know, and forgiveness is given for that. And I don't know if I may have said something terrible right there. I want to go justify in anger, but but it really...
That's what you didn't have to do, because
He says that's also right. That we cannot justify... The only thing we can do is pardon. That's what Williams, in one of his essays, says. It's a part of... Where did you say that? He calls it the... I think he loves the word exchange. He calls it the exchange of pardon.
Can I just read this? If you have, how much is this? 85 cents. This book is anyway.
I think there's
really,
only a
really
couple
good.
More left in the store.
Okay, well,
but it's excellent.
Be one of the two that gets the couple. Here are just a couple of lines, though. I mean, I really love one-liners because they really seem like they're. It's like a stone, and you throw it into a pond, you know, like the pond of yourself, and all of a sudden they just start rippling out and. And you make the kind of connections, and it makes me see my own life better. But this talks about his other books. I thought I spoke the truth, laments the repentant priest. And the flame replies, I know you did. But then the faith is much truer than you thought. And here's another one. And this is from one of his plays. It's Thomas Cranmer of Canterbury. And Cranmer says to Anne Boleyn, the king is gracious, referring to Henry. The king is gracious. And the skeleton interjects, heaven is gracious, but few can draw safe deductions on its methods. And I thought that was, you know, when she was beheaded. The price of heaven or hell or the world is similar, the skeleton tells Anne Boleyn. Always a broken heart, sometimes a broken neck.
He is I found the judgment one.
Okay.
The nearest to adverse judgment that we can go is to pass on to his own judgment, meaning God with capital H. The only judgment we are allowed to pronounce is pardon. Even that is only pronounced in his name. It is not for us to pardon from ourselves.
Where is that, Sonia?
That's in the Redeemed City essay.
Is that in the sense that forgiveness is already given? With the cross. You know when we were talking about that? You know, whether someone, if someone's got a gripe against you and you know, you feel like they haven't forgiven you or you haven't forgiven them, well, that's beside the fact because forgiveness has already been given.
That helps you to forgive.
Yeah.
I haven't heard this from Williams, you know, before, and it's really, because it's a theme I've been on for quite a while about that it isn't one of man's possibilities to justify or condemn. I mean, it just isn't a possibility. We try to do it, but it's as impossible as a round square for man to do it. I think he's talking the same thing here. We can't justify, we can't condemn. He's not talking about condemnation, but he's saying we can't.
Well, by judging, connotes the opposite of the mm-hmm. justification. It's a kind of either or. And we are not in a position because we are always and the pardon because we are pardoned in his name are able to pardon others, and that's the only way you can.
There's an implied judgment, not only in the sense of there's something wrong.
Right.
You don't pardon something that isn't wrong.
Right.
The best word for that kind of judgment is discernment. And that is something that we're told that Christ comes for discernment, so that we have discernment.
Yeah.
And we sometimes think that, we have to get rid of discernment in order not to judge. But we need to discern it, and then we need to know we're forgiven.
Right.
So that we can go and meet that.
Yeah, and his quote on humility, or his definition, humility consists in seeing things as they are, which is that discernment.
There may be some who have never experienced the healing that comes from being laughed at in love. The contemptuous laugh is destructive, and the laughter of comedy is diverting. But do not lover and beloved at the height of their passion sometimes break out into laughter at themselves? Do not parents sometimes find their dearly loved children irresistibly funny? Do we not penetratingly cure ourselves of our dismal pride with laughter? Laughter in love restores proportion, but it must be in love, and the kind of love that at once knows the absurdity of the beloved and loves him so much that he will die for him in public shame and lonely agony on a cross. William's term for this is defeated irony. I just thought that was... And his books have that sense. They're really powerful, and yet it's good. Well, thank you. Thank you for coming. Good night.
Thank you. I'm like...